Welcome to the Big Picture Long Term Audio for the Various Different Asset Classes. And today is January 20th, and it is 2:30 p.m. and that's Pacific Standard Time. And I thought that this week I would kick off with gold, because it has had 4 consecutive weeks on the upside. It has unwound its oversold condition relative to the trend mean, and there was such enthusiasm about the resumption of its medium-term bull market this time last year, which, and those hopes were largely dashed in the middle of the year, that it is now at such an important level that I thought this was something that subscribers would be interested in. This is the big question. After 4 consecutive weeks on the upside, is it going to be able to sustain a move back above the trend mean and then hold it? Or is it going to pull back and potentially find support above that low in the region of 1100. In either circumstance, if it can find a higher reaction low, then we would at least have some evidence to support the view that this is support building rather than a counter trend rally within an overall bear market environment. And that is why it is such a pivotal time right now, because we will probably know within the next 2, 3, or 4 weeks just where we are with the gold market. And something, of course, that we look at the chart seminar is that we look at how to anticipate markets. And one of the things that we look at is the consistency of the trend. And that is why I've put up the gold chart. Next thing we would look at is plenty of back history. And we've got about 10 years up on the chart right now, so we can see that there was a very big bull market. There was a well-defined top formation, and that was completed in I think it was, I'm going to pull this down, it was completed in 2013. We had a very well-defined downtrend, and we've had a big counter trend rally. So it is really for the bulls to prove. The next thing that we would look at is commonality, and then it is perhaps rather poignant that the silver prices have been leading on the upside, and that is certainly a bullish point. But when we look at it on the medium term chart, it is a similar situation, that silver has to get back above its trend mean. It has to put in a higher reaction low, and it hasn't yet done that. In the gold mining sector, in the short term, the gold mining sector has broken the progression of lower rally highs, but it is now in the region of the trend mean as well. So we do not yet have conclusive evidence of a return to demand dominance. When we look at, for example, the holdings of ETFs, the total holdings of physically backed ETFs, we are presented with a relatively similar story, that we had a big counter trend rally and demand has not returned in with the same alacrity that it had at the beginning of 2016. If we could see this holdings in ETFs pushing back above 60 million ounces, that would be an additional bullish characteristic. Where we perhaps have the greatest evidence of our return to demand dominance is in the platinum group metals. Platinum is trading in the region of its trend mean and in the region of the psychological 1,000 level. Today was a good day. It really does, though, need to get back above 1,000. That really is a psychological Rubicon. It was an area of resistance back in November. It was also an area of resistance earlier this week. And if it can sustain a move above 1,000, that would be at least some confirmation that we have a rally that has got more legs than simply just a very short-term move. And palladium, which has more industrial uses than precious metal uses, has been leading on the upside. It was additionally firm in here today, but this has been a very choppy environment overall. It is rapidly approaching the $800 level, and we can see that that was a big move here today, but it is a bit overbought. And every time that it has got to new highs, it has pulled back. What palladium really needs to do is to have a shallower pullback, and move into a more consistent advance, which would give us at least some indication that there is a demand-dominated environment and that the demand side is prevailing even during pullbacks. And of course, what have we seen in the media? There have been very conflicting stories, some saying that gold does better than equity markets in an inauguration year. And of course, today is Donald Trump's inauguration. I think it is interesting to look at the very long-term chart of the Dow divided by the gold price. We have a lot of back history. It goes back over 100 years. There is evidence of major bull markets, major bear markets. I think the most important characteristic is this progression of higher highs, that there are very clear manias in the equity market, that secular bull markets in equities can last for a very long time, over 20 years. Bull markets in gold don't tend to last 20 years. They tend to last in the region of 10 years, and we did have a 10-year bull market. That would suggest that even if we are in a bull market environment from a medium-term perspective for gold, it is unlikely that it is going to derail the potential for a secular bull market to outperform precious metals in equity, a secular bull market in equities to outperform precious metals over the long term. A secular bull market in equities that takes place could very well see it trading above 45 on this ratio, which would mean that the Dow Jones trades at over 45 times the price of gold. And considering that the low on this ratio was in 2011, then if it's a 20-year bull market, we could be seeing a big peak in equity prices in the early 2030s. Of course, that does not mean that the ratio is going to go up in a straight line, and we have evidence of that just last year with the big counter trend rally that we had in gold and the Dow doing not much of anything. Then that ratio did pull back, and when we look back at history, there are very choppy periods, even within a period when equities largely outperformed. There were choppy periods, and those represented big moves in the gold price. So it is, I think, a very pivotal time to be looking at gold because of this, where it is right now in terms of testing the region of the trend mean. But it is equally important to keep an eye on stocks. And I clicked through the constituents of the autonomy section of the chart library today, and I pulled out a number that are bouncing from rather large pullbacks and beginning to show evidence of a return to demand dominance. So Casino Guichard is now trading back above the 200-day moving average. And ABB, which is one of the leaders in terms of developing robotics, is pushing on to new high ground for the first time since 2008. Google today made a new high. Then what I thought was particularly interesting was that when you look at the shares that have had the big pullbacks and are beginning to start to muster investor interest once more, a large number of them are in Europe and Asia. So, for example, ExxonMobil really has been out in the cold for quite some time. And I'm not very good at typing. And it is now started, it appears at least to be garnering additional interest. So that it has now got this triangular pattern, and that is looking increasingly likely that it is going to be resolved on the upside. It would appear to be just in the region of breaking a progression of lower rally highs. And Bayer has perhaps got one of the most well-defined downtrends. And it has now broken its progression of lower rally highs. And if we stick with Germany, despite the fact that Volkswagen was caught up in the diesel and emissions cheating scandal, it has now broken upwards. BMW has broken upwards as well, and that was pulled back in sympathy, and it had underperformed for quite some time, but that has now broken upwards and is beginning to find support above the breakout point. Sensata, which is a producer of sensors that go into primarily diesel engines, is now breaking back above the $40 area and has held a progression of higher reaction lows for more than a year. When we look into Asia, Dairy Farm International, which is a big supermarket chain right across the ASEAN region, and went through a swingeing bear market, 14 to 6, is finding support in the region of the trend mean, has held a progression of higher reaction lows for over a year already. And ample evidence that the Chinese market really does have to be looked at not in black and white terms, but what we're starting to see is that a number of the Hong Kong-listed autonomies are starting to turn after big bear markets. Great Wall Motors would fall into that category. Lenovo, which really made a mess of one of the releases of its software, or, sorry, its hardware, back in 2015, is now testing the region of its trend mean. And the luxury goods sector had gone through quite a period of underperformance, and LVMH and Christian Dior have really been surging on the upside. But Prada, which trended lower for over 2 years, going from 80 to 20, has just broken on the upside. And that is quite a clear change in trend. Then, if we look at the gold miners, and there's only one gold miner in the list of autonomies, but Goldcorp has now bounced from above the low that we saw back in early January last year, and it is trading right above the 200-day moving average now. And then it is open to the same question as the rest of the precious metals: is it going to be able to hold it? Sticking with Europe, DSM in the chemical sector has firmed once more from the region of the trend mean. And when we look at some of the bigger US companies, Intel could well be now completing a first step above its base. And I think we do need to have some more back history to get some perspective on that. That this has been a lengthy range all the way from 2014 till now, but it is occurring mostly above the prior base formation. When we look at Kraft Heinz, I put that back into the autonomies because Berkshire Hathaway bought Heinz, so Berkshire Hathaway became a member, got taken out when they relisted Kraft Heinz, and that is now pushing back up towards to test its high. And Mondelez International, where we have this really very lengthy range, but it is now trading back above the trend mean and in the region of its previous peak. And by and large, when we look at, and it is a group of very large international companies that have got global businesses that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer, and most particularly to global GDP growth, there is a very small number that are still trading or trending lower. The defining characteristic is that they are starting to find support where they had pulled back, or they are already breaking on the upside. And that is interesting because there has been such incredible conversation about what the likely outcome of Trump's election is going to be. what is the effect that it is going to have on global trade? And I think that it is worth keeping in mind that one of the reasons that these big international US businesses expanded so aggressively internationally in the last 15 years was because demand was slowing down at home. And if the US can succeed in revitalizing growth and revitalizing domestic demand, then these are predominantly US businesses, and then that should also be good for the bottom line. And I think that that is something, that is one of the reasons that they should do well. There is an additional aspect to the autonomies that when we came up with the acronym, when we really went to look at the kinds of companies that could do well, then there was no mistake in the fact, it is not a coincidence that a large number of them are also dividend aristocrats, that these are the kinds of companies that have got long histories of increasing their cash flows. And in a potentially inflationary environment, that is going to be a very important characteristic. When we look at the government bond markets, this is a very big question. If we think we have a big question with precious metals, we have an even bigger question with the treasury market. Because when we look at this chart, we have had a counter trend rally, and it is quite similar in magnitude to that which we saw in 2013, and that was in relation to the taper tantrum. But we are in a different environment now because the Fed is raising interest rates, and the orthodoxy of extraordinary monetary policy and quantitative easing is being questioned, and not least because there has been a rise in populism, which is a direct reflection of the failure of monetary policy to give broad-based economic growth. That what it has certainly done, and we have ample evidence of, is that it has created asset price inflation, that it has pushed up the price of real estate, stocks, and bonds, that it has swelled the balance sheet of the Fed, or indeed a number of other central banks, but that it has not filtered down, or to use the parlance, trickled down to the common man, to the vast majority of people who have been left behind by the recovery. The fact that wages went nowhere, but the cost of healthcare, the cost of education, and energy costs all went up. That has been at least a large contributing factor to the rise of populism, and that is. And now we have President Trump. The fact that it is very likely that they are now going to introduce a raft of pro-cyclical policies. There is very little point in saying that it is a good idea or a bad idea, but rather that what are the effects of it likely to be? And it is because it is going to be that it is likely, and this is of course another big question, is how well will the new administration be able to take the conservative wing of the Republican Party with them when they go to raise the deficits. There has been a very distinct policy of trying to contain deficits in Washington for the last 5 years. It will look absolutely hypocritical if those very conservative policymakers now turn and decide that they would not give a stimulus program to Obama, but they will do it for Trump. Of course, politicians are not they're no strangers to hypocrisy, but it will be a big question. And if we do get deficit spending, and we can say that is because, and it can take many forms. It could be fiscal stimulus, or it could be lower taxes, or it could be deregulation. And deregulation is obviously the cheapest of them. But if we do have deficit spending, that is likely to create additional supply of bonds, and it could have a stimulative effect in terms of the economy, which would stimulate inflation. So what we have seen has been a big run-up in the yield, and we are getting a consolidation. The trend mean is now above 2%, and it is the trend mean that is going to be one of the big arbiters, because if this yield can hold above the trend mean, then it's still going to remain a bullish looking pattern. And of course, that would be bearish for stocks. And everything is priced off of the 10-year. So when we look at, for example, the S&P 500, and we can see that it hasn't really done very much of anything for the last month because it's been waiting to see what happens after the inauguration, but it's yielding about 2%. And for much of the last 5 or 6 years, equities have had very competitive yields relative to government bonds. But if government bonds move well beyond 2%, then they will have an additional premium relative to equities, and that is something that will be more attractive for bonds. It will certainly encourage somebody to be buying them if we get yields of 2 and 3%. And I guess we've already got 2%, but more than 2 and potentially 3 or even 4%. That is going to create a headwind for equities. Growth will have to be much stronger than it is right now. The policies that have been proposed will have to be implemented and then be successful in order for growth to pick up and for profit margins to expand, in order for PE ratios to come down. And that's quite a succession of events. We do have an overbought condition on the stock market at present. It isn't a big one, and it needn't be unwound immediately, but neither is it the most attractive period of time for opening positions, and that is part of the reason I think that the stock market has gone sideways. We also have to consider the fact that there is a large number of automatic trading systems in this market, and they will be looking at volatility, and they'll be looking at their risk reward. And the easiest time or type of automatic trading system to create is one that uses very well-defined measures. Volatility is the thing that is used to size positions, and it is very cheap right now, so therefore funds can have larger positions, because volatility has been so inert for the last 2 months, or I guess the last 6 weeks. Then we are inured into this false sense of security that the situation will persist. What we can definitely know, and it's something we talk about a lot at the chart seminar, is that a range is an explosion waiting to happen, and when this breaks, it is going to be a catalyst for investors to resolve their decision-making process. Because if it breaks on the upside, there will be a lot of people will say, "Great, now I know which way the market is going to go, so I'm going to buy." If it pulls back, well, then they're going to say, "Well, I know that it's at least going to go down and test the trend, the trend mean, so I'll put my bids in there, and in the meantime, I'll short it." And that is exactly what we would expect to happen. So either outcome is going to translate into a resolution on the part of bystanders in this rangy market. When I look at this market over the very long term, though, these are very short-term considerations. We had a very big and consistent advance from early 2009 all the way through to 2014, and we've had this lengthy volatile range since. Having gone through a lengthy volatile period, there is a temptation to expect that that volatility is going to persist, but it needn't necessarily be the case. And we have a good example of that from 2011, there was a big uptick in volatility in 2011. There was a large amount of fear afterwards. We didn't really know what was going to happen in terms of monetary stimulus. And we had a similar situation from 2014 through to the beginning of last year. We didn't really know what was going to happen in terms of monetary policy. What we did not know, and of course we know that last year the Fed was saying that they were going to raise interest rates four times in 2016 and decided in the end to only raise once, and then at the tail end of the year. So they're going to be extraordinarily cautious. When the Fed says that they are data dependent, it means that they are not going to preempt the market. They're going to wait for evidence. And that virtually ensures that they are going to be somewhat behind the curve. They are looking at the fact that the earnings have already broken out. And of course, the problem with looking at some of these economic statistics is that they don't update particularly often. But when this last updated, it was breaking on the upside. And if earnings are breaking out, then that gives us at least some indication that the lengthy period where wages were not rising is over, and that we have had a base formation, a first step above the base, and now it is resolving on the upside, and wages are rising year on year at 2.9%. Well, you can kind of massage inflation figures, but it's very hard to argue with the fact that if people are asking for more money to do the same job, then you have got inflation. And that is not good news for the bond markets. It means that people will start looking for hedges to inflation that is bullish for equities. Equities generally tend to advance at least in line with inflation. And if we ever wanted evidence for that, we could just look at Venezuela, where they have hyperinflation. The continuous commodity index has broken its progression of lower rally highs. It has bounced from the region of the trend mean. It is coming off of very depressed levels. The vast majority of commodities trended lower for a prolonged period between 2011 and 2016. And we have not seen it yet sustain a move above 450, but it is looking increasingly likely that that is a potential outcome for this year. It's an unweighted index, but of course, oil prices have got a big influence on what happens with the rest of the commodity sector. Oil is by far the biggest and most liquid of all the commodity markets. And it is posting a first step above this range. We had the massive reaction against the we had the acceleration lower, the massive reaction against that prevailing downtrend, right-hand extension, and now this price is still ranging above that underlying range. And oil prices were up about a dollar today. And I think there, and I've posted an article talking about the Jevons paradox, and it came in at a time when I just happened to be thinking about it in view of the of President Trump's inaugural address, where he said they wanted to become energy independent. And energy independence is achievable, but the bigger question is whether it is sustainable, because of the Jevons paradox. When prices go down, and the only way that the US would become energy independent is to massively boost domestic supply. If prices were to come down, then demand would rise. It's hard to imagine that demand could rise because we are have been through a decade where we have really considered nothing other than efficiency and trying to use less of it because prices were so expensive. And then we've also tried to rely on alternatives and on technological advances to try and reduce the cost of production. But if we do get more supply coming through, and that is a distinct possibility because prices are already economic for a significant number of producers. They have been contending with a regulatory environment which has been, and I think it is no exaggeration to say, hostile towards the fossil f development of fossil fuels. And that has been most particularly the case for offshore. The Macondo accident, where you had a massive and lengthy crude oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, put a cap on drilling in the Gulf for years. Now we already have the Trump administration talking about opening up the Arctic Reserve for exploration, and there is almost certainly oil under it. But removing some of the very stiff regulations on offshore drilling, well, we also know that there's a great deal of oil in the USA's territorial waters. These are, and while it might be more difficult to invest in the Arctic Reserve, we already know the kinds of companies that do well from drilling in the Gulf, and they offshore drilling companies represent some of the most depressed energy shares around right now, and they could benefit most from a change. If they could go up, we also have to consider that the healthcare sector is doesn't look particularly healthy. It had this incredibly persistent advance all the way from 2011 all the way through to the middle of 2015, and that's given way to a very volatile range. And while the wider market has broken upwards, healthcare has not. There are a number of reasons for that, and I think a lot of them right now are political. These are short-term considerations, and longer-term considerations are the cost of developing new drugs. What the healthcare sector has relied upon has been to raise the price of existing drugs because they are not coming up with new drugs quick enough, and the cost of doing so is prohibitively expensive. That is not a happy combination of circumstances. This chart suggests that the S&P 500 healthcare sector could be developing a Type 3 top formation. If, in fact, the new administration goes ahead and says that insurance companies and hospitals can negotiate more aggressively, that US consumers will be able to buy their medication overseas, then that is going to be very bad news for pharmaceutical companies generally. They generally tend to have much higher prices in the US than they do just about everywhere else. US consumers have, in many respects, subsidized the cost of pharmaceuticals globally, and that might well be coming to an end. If that is the case, then either prices will have to go up globally, but they will almost certainly come down in the US, and then can these higher prices, where the index had rallied from 350 to 900, can they be sustained in that kind of environment? That is quite apart from the argument about just what the impact of biotechnology is going to be on established pharmaceutical companies. So far, what has happened is that big pharmaceutical companies have just bought biotech. In many respects, they have offshored, or they have not so much offshored, but they have delegated R&D to the biotech sector. And when promising new treatments are coming up, they just buy the company. That is perhaps their only route to growth. It is interesting that GlaxoSmithKline is bucking this trend somewhat. It has bounced. It has held this progression of high reaction lows for a year and a half, but this was a big downward dynamic this week. And that really will need to hold the 1450 area if the upward bias is to hold. This is not a consistent trend. It is much more difficult to work with. Merck in the US is perhaps somewhat more consistent, and it has stabilized in the region of its trend mean. and it is out of is performing out of character with the more bearish outlook for the S&P 500 healthcare sector. So that would suggest that there are going to be exceptions, and those exceptions are going to be the companies that have either got bigger global businesses or have got better drug pipelines. If companies are simply relying on their legacy products and thinking that they're going to be able to charge more for them, that is no longer politically tenable. Well, the likelihood is that we're going to have a number of changes in the US, in the way the US economy works. That is going to have far-reaching effects for the rest of the global market. And I was looking at long-term charts before I started recording. And we've looked at long-term charts for the S&P 500, but I think it is interesting that Taiwan has been in a large volatile range since 1997. So this is a 20-year ranging environment, and it is eking its way back up towards the upper side of that range. And the day that it can sustain a move above 10,000 is likely to be a big one. The Korean market has really done not much of anything at all for the last 5 years, and it is now pushing back up towards the upper side of that range, and 2200 is going to be a big level if it can sustain a move to new all-time highs. And this long-term chart, where we see that there was a very volatile ranging environment all the way through until about 2005, and then we have 100% advance. And that 100% advance was entirely given up during the credit crisis, and then it just got all the way back up to the peak and then did nothing. So this market has been locked around the 2000 level for the better part of a decade. And if it can sustain a move to new highs, it's likely to be new bull market territory. The interesting thing is that we have a great example of what a first step above the base can be in India, but not now. That big first step above the base was in 2003, 2004, and then we gave way to this very large bull market. We went through a very lengthy ranging phase and then another big break on the upside. And the Indian market has stabilized around the 8,000 level. There is the big question about the ramifications of the demonetization, and not so much what the long-term impact of that is going to be on the domestic economy, because it will probably wash through the economy within the next 6 months. I think the bigger question is what's it likely to do for the currency, and is it going to have a big impact on Modi's chances of being re-elected? The Indian rupee is currently trading around 68, and this has been a pretty well-defined uptrend for the US dollar. We can see that in that big period when the Indian market was advancing in a very pronounced fashion, the rupee was actually appreciating all the way through from 2000 through to about 2008. Since 2008, the rupee has been depreciating. If it can break this progression of if it can break the progression of the dollar's higher reaction lows, then that would be a green light for the Indian market. I think a lot of people are probably watching the Indian market and thinking that there's got to be a buying opportunity coming up at some point, but the rupee has been so weak that it has represented a headwind for foreign investors to invest, because what they're making the stock, they're probably losing, or at least their nominal appreciation is being eroded by the weakness of the currency. And we haven't had the ranging phase, the basing activity in India that we have in some of these other markets. I was also looking at the Thai market. It isn't something that I've commented on very much recently, but the set index is now testing the upper side of a range that has been there since 2013. And when we look at it over the very long term, then that range is occurring in the region of the 1994 peak. So we could rationalize it by saying that maybe this is just a big range in the region of the previous peak. A sustained move above that 1600 area would put Thailand back in, would put it back to new all-time highs, and then people might be looking at the baht and questioning whether this is just nominal price appreciation or whether it has got some legs. And it is interesting here that the baht hit a low around 36.5, but that was in the latter portion of 2015, and it has been relatively stable since. Now, with the US dollar strengthening, that represents a big challenge for the rest of the world in terms of attracting investment dollars. Because if the dollar is strong and Wall Street is doing well, then there is no incentive for capital to leave the US. And because it is a developed market, because you have got the security and the regulatory environment and the established corporate governance, then the risks of investing in the US, or the perception of the risk of investing in the US, is lower than investing elsewhere. The dollar index has broke out of its range. It has pulled back towards the 100 level. The 200-day moving average is coming back up towards it. It is at a point where, if the dollar is going to continue to hold this breakout, then it is going to have to rally soon. It is really for the bears to prove, though, because this has been a big breakout in 2014. It's really just been a range, and it has resolved on the upside. And this is so far nothing more than a consolidation in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. It would really need to break down in a dynamic fashion below 100 and back into that range to signal a failed upside break. If that were to occur, then we would anticipate that the index would come all the way back down towards 92. And that's a big ask at where we are right now. The best that we can hope for from emerging markets is that they continue, or at least that their currencies are reasonably steady. That and the Mexican peso is an example of exactly what investors do not want to see. They don't want to see a currency accelerating lower against the US dollar. It's probably not a bad time to be booking holidays in Mexico, but other than that, this is going to create a competitive advantage for the Mexican economy. And then there is a question whether the currency will go down enough so that it will offset the potential tariffs that might be imposed from any renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. That is still the big question for the Mexican peso. When we look at the Chinese market, then we can't help but look at the currency, and it is still in a well-defined downtrend against the US dollar, or the dollar, on this chart at least, is trending in a consistent manner higher against the renminbi. It bounced from the region of 6.75 over the last week. Excuse me, bounced from above 6.8. So far, this has a relatively similar sized reaction to that we saw back in July. Occasionally, we've seen that the Chinese come in and chasten the market and try and push some of the short sellers out. But there is no denying that they want a weaker currency, and they need a weaker currency. They need a weaker currency in order to push through the raft of reforms that they are trying to impose, and they need it to support their manufacturing sector. The A-share market bounced this week from the region of the trend mean. And that's pretty much where it absolutely needed to bounce. On Monday, it was the Shenzhen B shares pulled back really quite sharply. And the A shares pulled back in sympathy, but were able to recoup the majority of their losses. But the broader question is whether, if we look at that weekly chart and we ask very simple filter questions, is this a ranging or a trending market? And the best we can say is that it's ranging. And it's not even ranging in an inert fashion, it's ranging in a volatile fashion. The index obviously found support in the last couple of days of this week and has closed off the lows, but it has a lot of work to do to convince investors that this is anything other than a volatile ranging phase, and the easiest money in markets is often made in the trending phases. We would much prefer to see a trending environment rather than this rangy environment, because there are lots of markets that are trending. There are plenty of markets that are either breaking to new highs or bouncing from the region of their trend means or breaking medium-term downtrends. That's where the opportunities are. That's where the easy money is. Whereas participating with the Shenzhen B shares at these levels, looking at the potential for the renminbi to depreciate, then those are potential headaches. The European markets have got potential headaches this year. We know what they are. Most particularly, it has to do with what exactly are going to happen with the elections. There has been so much conversation about what is going to happen with the UK. And an even bigger question is, despite all the preparation for negotiation, will there even be an EU to negotiate with once we have a Dutch, French, and German election result behind us? That is a very big question. And I have posted earlier in this audio a number of those European shares that are breaking back above their respective trend means, breaking medium-term downtrends. But what do they all have in common? It's kind of simple, isn't it? They have big global businesses. They would be some of the primary beneficiaries of the dissolution of the euro. Their respective currencies would likely dip. That would probably not be great news for some of the German companies, but it would probably be better for just about everywhere else. So certainly one of the reasons that we have had such incredible interest in German bunds has been because investors have looked on them as a hedge. But those bond yields do not look like they are going down anytime soon. That would suggest that even German bunds are beginning to price in the end of quantitative easing, and even potentially that we're going to get inflation in Europe, because golly, they need it. And if they're going to hold it together, then they need to abandon the fiscal austerity mantra. That will either require a real change of tone in Germany, or it's going to require a crisis. But either way, they need to abandon fiscal austerity. And that would suggest that we have morphed in the last decade from periods of global economic expansion to global monetary expansion, and within the next few years, there is the very real prospect that we get global fiscal expansion. And global fiscal expansion could be the could really unlock the potential for greater inflation. If we do in fact get the dissolution of the euro, it is probably bad news for creditor nations, but it is wonderful news for debtor nations. And the economies, particularly on the periphery of Europe, have been incredibly burdened by debt repayments, which have been punitive in nature for much of the last decade. If the euro disappears, then they really would have an incredible benefit handed to them, and that that would be a green light for global investors to get interested in Europe once more. But probably after the decline that would almost certainly ensue the dissolution of the euro. That is certainly something that we need to worry about. There is an additional consideration. The resources sector continues to do very well. That would suggest that we, even if we are in a secular bull market, we are perhaps in the latter stages of the beginning of the bull market, and that the return to performance of the resources sector, highly cyclical sectors, would suggest that we're in the latter stages of the expansion that began in 2009. What we also saw this week, and it's something that has really been sticking in my mind, is that last year China imported 1 billion tons of iron ore. And if they are not investing any longer in building roads or railways to nowhere, or building cities that are going to remain vacant for decades, then what is all the iron ore for? Well, China's only got one aircraft carrier, and Xi Jinping has already said that he doesn't want to leave office. And the blogosphere is rife with speculation about what China is going to do about Taiwan. Well, if you have ambitions on global dominance and you need a bigger military, then developing stockpiles of key commodities would be a major part of that kind of strategy. And certainly, if she is looking for a reason to stay in power and not give way to the next generation of political leaders, then he could be looking for a war to use as an excuse to extend his tenure in office. So he is not due for to give up his post for another couple of years. That would suggest that perhaps China might be bellicose now, but they're unlikely to start anything, at least until the year before he's due to give up power. And that is not a prediction just yet, but merely a rumination. But I thought that perhaps best to talk about these topics now rather than after the event. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.